From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. It is being called the biggest tragedy to date involving migrants crossing the English Channel. At least 27 migrants bound for Britain died Wednesday when their inflatable boat sank. Three were children. Now, this is hardly an isolated incident, as refugees flee poverty and conflict in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia. And now, the leaders of France and Britain are pointing fingers at each other over who's responsible. For some context, let's talk now to Michael Bohenik. He's senior counsel at Human Rights Watch and focuses on juvenile justice and refugee and migrant children. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, we have been hearing about the crisis of migration since at least 2015. How does what we're seeing now compare to what's been happening over these several years?
Well, I guess the first thing is that people have been traveling to northern France since at least the last 5 or 6 years, and in fact, well before then, famously settling in large numbers, or at least gathering in large numbers, in what was often somewhat derogatorily called the jungle, a very, very large migrant camp on the edge of Calais in northern France. And the reasons for them leaving their home countries, traveling through Europe, and trying to get to the UK haven't changed all that much in broad strokes. I'm consistently hearing people tell me about repression in their home countries, family members being targeted, death threats, in addition to the sort of war, the conflict, and poverty that are obviously part of the backdrop. I think what really has changed is only the tactics that French and British authorities are using to respond.
Okay, I understand. And I do want to ask about the European government's response. But maybe first of all, just staying on these human beings here, we know many of these are children and they're coming with families. Can you help us out with this, with what this looks like? Can you put a human face on these numbers of who is making this journey?
Sure. And I guess that's another thing that really has been shifting over time, which is more children traveling alone, more families traveling with young children. I talked to a 14-year-old boy a couple of months ago who left his home country. His parents had been imprisoned. He's coming from Eritrea. And he was looking around at a climate of repression and facing the really high likelihood that he would be drafted into the army and would probably die as a result. And so he and his family took a really difficult decision for him to leave and travel to Europe. And he made his way to France eventually and was in Calais hoping to cross the channel the way that so many people have in the last few months. When I asked him why he wouldn't stay in France or why he didn't stay in Italy, it's a combination of reasons, and some of them have to do with the ideas that people come with. In his case, he spoke English but not French. He had family members in England, not in France. He also was talking about being evicted every other day by the French police. He was talking about having them take his tent and slash it with knives. He was talking about having to find a sleeping bag because the police had taken one just a few days before, and so he'd been sleeping in the cold. And all of these things also, of course, make a difference. He can't comprehend that France is a safe place for him where he could seek asylum if his only contact with the French state is one where police are harassing him, are telling him to move on, are telling him he's not wanted, and are taking the very, very meager things that he has that he needs to survive.
Wow. And so you and your colleagues at Human Rights Watch are working on behalf of people like this teenager, and you're seeing this diplomatic spat, right, between the French and the UK. The British want the French to stop the migrants from crossing the channel. The French say they're going to try to reach the UK anyway. And you know, we're seeing invitations being withdrawn, just kind of this diplomatic tension. What would you say to these governments about this crisis and how to address it?
Well, the diplomatic spat is really beside the point. This is turning into a bit of a sideshow that is really a distraction and really unnecessary. But I think the bigger thing is for all countries in the European Union, together with the United Kingdom, to sit down and figure out a better, fairer way of receiving asylum seekers and processing asylum claims, right? It shouldn't be that people feel driven away from the first countries they arrive in the European Union, and then end up feeling like they have no choice but to take these really perilous journeys. There should be some way of figuring out, right, if I've got relatives in Germany, why don't I go there? If I've got relatives in France, why can't I stay there? If I've got relatives in the UK, why can't I get a visa to go there and then try to figure out my asylum situation?
Michael Bohanek is a senior counsel for Human Rights Watch. Thank you.
Thank you.
It has been a busy week of travel, and with that comes airport screening. And if you have a certain type of hair, you may find yourself subjected to a hair pat-down. Femi OK, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera, joins us now to share her pat-down story and why many travelers think the TSA screening technology is discriminatory. Femi, how are you?
Hi, very well, thank you. My hair survived that particular experience, but shall I tell you what happened, Scott?
You were on a flight a couple of weeks ago. What happened?
Mm-hmm. So I have afro hair and I usually wear it braided up in a bun, and my bun roves around my head depending on my mood and what month it is. Sometimes it's a big bun, sometimes it's a little bun. Huh. Invariably, I get stopped at airport security. Going through Dulles Airport, I got stopped. The TSA officer just went to touch my hair, didn't ask, just went straight for my head. I said, hold on a minute, change your gloves, please. Then she was in a really bad mood, came back, very petite officer. I'm only 5'4", but she couldn't reach the top of my head. So she said, bend down. I was so shocked and embarrassed. And then I sort of leant over. She's like, I can't reach you. Bend down some more. Remembering I'm only 5'4". So he grabbed hold of my hair, ripped my hair, and then started messing up my bun. Then I said, you need to stop. And she said, well, do you want to speak to my supervisor? And I said, absolutely, yes. That is one example of many examples. Usually I just suck it up, Scott, and don't say anything. But that particular one, I did file a complaint because it was humiliating. Bending down, having someone touch your hair and messing it all up. But it's not unusual. It's happened to many men who have locks or long hair, many women who have Afro-styles hair, and also women who wear hijab as well. It wasn't unusual. It was just that I was particularly annoyed on that occasion.
Now, you spoke to Robert Carter Langston, a media relations professional at the TSA. Let's take a listen to what he said.
Frankly, you'd be surprised what can be hidden in hair. The most notable things we're looking for in hair are explosives and improvised explosive device components. Any explosive amount could cause injury.
So that's the TSA view. Mm-hmm. But since this, as you describe, can pull aside a lot of African-American travelers, is this a question of discrimination to you?
So let's see what the machines are doing. The body scanners are seeing dense material, i.e. afro hair or thick curly hair, an alarm goes off. So somewhere in that technology, it is not being calibrated for thicker afro hairstyles, buns, and locks. Robert also told me earlier, the TSA screening technology does not detect or discriminate against skin, color, religion, or other variables. But so many people of color are being pulled through for hair pat-downs on a regular basis.
Now, does the TSA acknowledge this, that this, perhaps not intended, but it certainly is pulling aside certain types of people?
They've tried to tell their TSA officers how to do pat-downs to be culturally sensitive. It's not necessarily working.
So what to do? Again, Robert Carter Langston at the TSA shared a couple suggestions with you. Let's take a listen.
For travel tip, using non-metallic hairpins or accessories may reduce the likelihood of having your hair patted down.
And Femi, what advice do you have for preventing hair pat-downs or enduring them if you find yourself in that situation?
I've got some advice for the TSA, actually, and that is they are saying that they always are looking for enhancements to security, enhancements for the equipment. So maybe they can look to see how do you make the body scanners more culturally sensitive so they recognize an afro or a bun or hair locks, because they can do an awful lot of things, but maybe not recognize different textures of hair. That would be a great step forward. And then for when we're thinking about design of tech and maybe tech that could be even be called racially insensitive. Who are the designers? Who are the developers? Are they diverse? Are we actually testing this technology on a whole range of people so we don't get situations like me at the airport, but also more important things like medical devices that don't recognize darker skin and people with different ethnicities? That is a whole lot more serious than perhaps me and many people with Afro hair being upset at the airport. We could actually be saving lives if our tech was more diverse and developed in a more diverse way, Scott.
Yeah, well, and as you're saying, there is facial recognition technology that misidentifies people with darker skin, as do self-driving cars. So this is a broader society and technology problem. Femi Okay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
As the calendar goes, America's longest war ended in August with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. But for the men and women who fought there, you can imagine the memories and the demons remain with them. A new podcast, Third Squad, tells the story of 1st Battalion 5th Marines sent to Afghanistan's Helmand province in 2011. This was the bloodiest stage of the war, the so-called surge. 12 men deployed, 11 returned alive. Now, before going on, we should note that this conversation deals with descriptions of war and violence that may not be suitable for all listeners. The host of Third Squad is a journalist and veteran himself, Elliot Woods, and Elliot joins us. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
You embedded with Third Squad back in 2011, and you know, from the audio, they were frankly a bunch of kids, right? Some just out of high school. And then a decade later, you go on this trip to reconnect with them. What's the origin story of this project?
Yeah, so the origin story is, like you said, I went on this embed with this group of Marines in Sangin District in Helmand Province back in 2011. I came home from that embed just completely exhausted. And then, as the story of the podcast tells, one of the young men who I interviewed and photographed got killed shortly after I left. And so I just figured, I don't know if I can do this anymore. The risks that I was taking didn't seem justifiable to me anymore, and I was just worn out. But I always felt bad about turning my back on that mission. I always felt like I abandoned something. So 10 years later, I decided to go find these guys who made such a deep impression on me and see what had become of their lives and what they made of the war after all those years. So that's what I did.
Now, you mentioned the one member of the squad who died in Afghanistan. Michael Dutcher was killed by an IED, and his death hits his colleagues very hard. Here's Marine Manuel Mendoza describing what happened.
I'm looking at Dutcher, he's right in front of me, and then the whole world turns brown, and then black. Next thing I know, I got my hand on his flag, and I'm pulling him out of this crater, and he's just covered in dust. His leg is destroyed. He's got a hole on his pelvis. A giant hole.
Now, a decade later, Mendoza tells you he's haunted by guilt about Dutcher's death. He blames himself. He considers at one point taking his own life. And these are things he's never talked about. He describes reliving that moment, feeling everything all at once, the fear, the apprehension, the exhaustion.
And then doubt. Or you start wondering what you could have done different. That what if? And you start thinking, why are you alive? Why am I alive?
So, Elliot, I guess, what did you tell him to get him to talk about this?
Well, there's a part in that episode where Mendoza gets to a point where he says he doesn't really want to tell these particular stories because he worries that it would be disrespectful to the families of the dead and disrespectful to his dead friends.
Yeah.
And I told him before the interview, I told all these guys before the interview, you have the wheel and I'm going to point out some places that I want to go, but you decide how close we go or if we go there at all. And if you want to stop and take a break at any time, or if you just want to shut it down, we'll do that. So that happened in this interview and we shut the recorder down. And I told Mendoza about why I became a journalist and why I was out there talking to them. I told him the story of two guys from my unit who were killed by a suicide bomber on December 21st, 2004. And I told him about how I went to Afghanistan in the first place because I thought that Americans needed to hear these stories and we weren't paying enough attention back home. And the silence I thought was dangerous. And I told him about how the first story that I ever wrote as a journalist was about the parents of those two guys from my unit who were killed. And how I know what it's like to worry about disrespecting the dead or making these kinds of horrific incidents profane. And eventually he said, okay, let's do it. Let's talk. As you can hear with Mendoza, it led to him opening a locked place inside of himself and letting out some things that had really been torturing him.
Well, Elliot, we also hear this in your podcast with John Bollinger, another member of this squad. 10 years ago, John Bollinger, the kid in Afghanistan, professes himself as this out-and-out killer. Let's listen.
Firefights are fun. I enjoy firefights. You drop bombs on people and kill bad men. That's what we're here for.
And then he comes home to his wife and his young son, and he's mentally wounded. He's suffering from PTSD, and he and his wife tell you they realize he's not okay.
I don't think it was really until, you know, second week being back, woke up in the middle of the night getting choked.
So John Bollinger seeks professional help. And suddenly John and his wife are shamed at Camp Pendleton where they live. They're shunned by the people around them. You're a veteran yourself. What do you make of this system, this mental health system?
So the Marine Corps is an incredibly rigid culture that values bravery, courage, and physical strength and determination above all else. Hmm. And so anybody who's seen as weak in any way is a risk. And I think there's been progress over the years. But I think at the time that Bollinger was coming home from Sangin, that deeply entrenched culture that saw any kind of admission of mental weakness as a liability was still very, very much alive. And so he goes to seek help from a Navy therapist, counselor, and immediately he's made aware in the unit that he's basically not welcome anymore. And so that was a terrible time in his life. And fortunately for him, and this really speaks to his perseverance, he didn't give up on it. He kept going. He kept seeking help through the military, even though they didn't make it easy for him. And then when he got out of the Marine Corps, he kept seeking help everywhere he moved after that from the VA. And he's still in therapy a decade later and has made tremendous progress in his therapeutic journey.
Well, there's this striking moment in John's story. He's back in the States and he sees this 12-year-old kid and a memory from Afghanistan just hits him.
There's this kid who was 12, 13. Couldn't have been much older. And we were in a gunfight. And I saw him and I didn't want to take the shot. But he was shooting. He had an AK. I had to take the shot. I didn't want to take the shot, but I had to take the shot. That's the one That's the one.
You know, Elliot, as I listen to this, I feel like a voyeur. I mean, this is so raw. And so the question for you is, what is the point of bringing us, the listener, so close to these men?
I don't think anybody who hasn't been to war, witnessed these horrifying events up close, or in some cases perpetrated them, which is what John Bollinger is talking about. I don't think there's any way for somebody who hasn't been there to really know what it's all about. But I think we all have a duty to try our hardest to understand what it is that we're asking of people when we ask them to go kill and die on behalf of the country. And of those two things, the killing and the dying, I think the killing is the thing that we're most embarrassed to talk about. We're most ashamed of. And so what that act does to the people who commit it, to some of them, not all of them, but to a good number of them, is incredibly transformative and powerful. And it can be a form of trauma, or to use another phrase, moral injury, that affects people's lives forever. So My goal with this entire project is to bring people into the room to really sit with the consequences of these wars that have been so far from most people's consciousness, to basically ask them to reckon with the human costs and consequences to the people that we ask to do this on our behalf. And I think John Bollinger and Manny Mendoza and these other guys were incredibly brave to open up and talk about their private pain.
And as far as reckoning for you, you set out in this project to ask, what was this all for? And where do we go from here? How do you and how do these men answer those questions?
Well, everybody has a slightly different answer, but on the level of the frontline troop, the answer to the question, what was it all for, is we did it for each other. We were fighting for each other, to keep each other alive and to support each other. Not all of them have an answer to the bigger question of what was it all for? Why did we spend 20 years in Afghanistan? Why did 2,500 people die there and tens of thousands of other people get wounded? Most of them don't have an answer to that question. And to be honest with you, I don't have a great answer to that question either. But I also think it's my job as a journalist and it's our job as civilians and citizens to demand answers to that bigger question. Why was all of this sacrifice necessary? Why was all of this damage done? And so that's a question that I'll continue asking and seeking to answer throughout the rest of the series and probably for the rest of my life.
Well, it is a powerful listen. Elliot Woods is a veteran and multimedia journalist and the host of the podcast Third Squad. You can find it, as they say, wherever you find your podcasts. Elliot, thank you.
Thank you very much, Scott. It's been great to talk to you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Stock market indices fell more than 2% today, after similar falls in Japan, Germany, and the UK. This all after reports of a new COVID variant in South Africa. In fact, the price of crude oil in the US fell a whopping 12%. So let's unpack this with Robin Farzad here again. He's host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. And Robin, can you translate market into English for us? What are stocks down, oil down telling us?
No comprende market? Okay. The pandemic has hosted the pandemic has hosted such an enormous bull market, Scott, such a streak of near daily records and such risk-taking that it's not unreasonable to have a pullback on signs here, as you explained, that COVID isn't necessarily going away. If airlines are now mindful of the South African variant, then you reflexively worry about jet fuel demand. Oil, we know, has had a major run. It is getting clobbered today. On the flip side, when you see a flight to safety, that means bond prices go up. People pile into the perceived safety of treasuries. Having said all that, still a 900-point drop on the Dow just represents 2.5%, so it's not exactly panic.
Yeah, right. I understand. And we certainly have seen on a percentage basis much bigger falls. For those of us on Main Street watching this, is it necessarily a bad thing? I mean, it's always framed as a bad thing, but you know, if oil prices fall, then gasoline gets cheaper, for instance.
True, but it's cold comfort if a tanking economy or a panic takes oil prices down with it. I mean, think back to the spring of 2020. No one was out binging fuel when petroleum was in free fall at the outset of the pandemic. But you're right. On balance, if it persists, it's going to make its way to gas prices, which have crept well above $3, and they've been in a multi-year high.
Now, this is one day. We often say, you know, for example, with a scientific study, this is just one study. Should we be careful making too much of one day in the markets?
I mean, what is the market ever telling us, Scott? It reminds me of that 1993 song. Remember, What is Love? Baby, Don't Hurt Me. This is a game of love and you know, euphoria and pain and everything. If you're going to be in the market, it can't just be up, 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 up. Do people forget the lost decade of 2000 to 2009? Do people forget what happened in 08 and 09? Yes, now the obverse is that risk appetites are so great that you could take, you know, a trash can public. But yes, it helps to remember that markets can and do fall apart. And actually what has been happening with daily records is not quite normal.
Okay, turning the page to Black Friday very quickly. Any indication that this will be a big version of it this year? I mean, we know consumers are two-thirds of the engine growing our economy.
Oh, yeah. BAFO numbers. Stores are having difficulty keeping inventory on the shelves, and inventory has been a problem. So, yes, this is a healthy indicator on balance, but with fears about inflation and interest rates, I don't think many Americans were banking on COVID, you know, lingering into 22 like this. But here we are talking about flights to and from South Africa, shipping ports still dealing with backlogs, and people just desperate to buy things, and yet there's stubborn infection rates. You have to take the good and take the bad if you're going to be in markets at all. And this is the price of admission.
Yeah. Robin Fireside, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. He's joined us a few times this week, so thanks as always for the time.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
And you. Okay, when you think of America's friends in the world of spying, what country comes to mind? Britain, Canada, maybe Australia? Well, how about Poland? Yeah, Polish operatives have been spying for U.S. interests around the world in an intelligence partnership that goes back three decades. A new book explores this, and it includes a fascinating top-secret rescue account of Americans in Iraq. The book is From Warsaw with Love: Polish Spies, the CIA, and the Forging of an Unlikely Alliance. And the author is John Pomfret, who joins us. John, good to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
Now, you established early on in the book that the Poles have some really good spies. During the Cold War, when Poland was still communist, its agents actually stole a lot of industrial secrets from us, the U.S., yeah?
Exactly. Not only industrial secrets, they actually stole some of the family jewels in terms of an early iteration of American stealth technology. So very high-level military secrets as well.
Yeah. But then the Berlin Wall comes down after Reagan's famous speech about this in 1987.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
And then post-communist Poland wants to befriend the West and NATO, and specifically the United States. So, John, what is the broader affinity here?
So, first, there's a very strong cultural bond between Poland and the United States. I mean, there's 9 million Polish Americans. But there's also the reality that the CIA had known of Polish excellent tradecraft during the Cold War, and the CIA very much was committed to the possibility that once the Cold War ended, the Polish government wouldn't fire all their spies. They would actually just sort of change their hats, and instead of working for the Soviet Union, they'd begin working for us.
And it happens pretty quickly. Soon after the Iron Curtain falls, the CIA asks Polish intelligence for help in Iraq. Now, before we ask you to tell that story, how did Washington end up turning to Poland anyway for this project?
So Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait in August of 1990, and lots of countries have people in Baghdad and also in Kuwait that they need to get out quickly. And we have six officers, a couple of military officers, NSA communicators, and CIA officers that we need taken out of Iraq. And we asked the British, the French, and the Russians, even the Russians at the time, to help us. And they're too busy getting their own people out. So we asked the Poles. And it made sense to ask the Poles because at the time, the Poles had thousands of workers in Iraq building sewage treatment plants and roads, et cetera. So if they wanted to embed intelligence officers, for example, in that group, it would be relatively easy. So we went to the Poles, and the Poles said yes.
And the Polish agent in charge of this mission, I mean, this is fascinating. He lands in Baghdad, tells the Americans to disguise themselves and pretend they're Polish, but then their Polish pronunciation is terrible. So new plan.
Right. So he brings in six Polish workers' overalls. He brings in also six fake Polish passports with six fake Polish names, which were written for an American pronunciation. So they were relatively easy Polish names to pronounce. But these Americans couldn't even pronounce those names. So he kind of makes the strategic decision to literally douse them with Johnny Walker Black so that they would look like drunken Eastern Europeans who could no longer speak.
Now we have a little piece of sound from Fred Hart, one of the Americans captured in Iraq, talking to the podcast SOFREP.
He came back the next time we had our little meeting. You know, he had satchels full of Johnny Walker Red and whiskey and everything else. And he said, you know, you're going to keep this stuff on you. He said, I'm going to tell the Iraqis, y'all are just a bunch of drunk Polish construction workers.
Drunk Polish construction workers. John, how in the world did this possibly work?
Well, I mean, it was stage managed by this remarkable Warsaw Pact spy named Gromosław Chempinski, who had worked around the world against the United States. So he was really a consummate professional, a risk taker, but a fellow who didn't take crazy risks. And actually, one of the problems that they faced was as they were doing their research into which direction they would take these Americans out of Iraq, they concluded that there were several Polish-speaking Iraqi border guards, and they needed to avoid them. They determined that these Iraqi border guards were in the south of Iraq, but then as they moved north towards Turkey, they bumped into one of the Polish-speaking border guards. He'd obviously been redeployed.
But they get past this guy. Is this when they're, I mean, they bribed a lot of people along the way. How did they get past this guy?
Well, they basically hugged him and kissed him and declined an offer to have lunch. And the Americans were in the car kind of literally pretending to be drunk, but actually, you know, through their lidded eyelids, they were watching this whole thing unravel. And they're like, okay, we're sunk. We're done. But both Chempinski, the Polish spy, and an engineer who was working with him really were perfect at dealing with this guy and keeping him away from the car, and then ultimately allowing him to drive north towards Turkey.
Yeah, wow. So that's one big episode you write about in your book. Another one is when U.S. intelligence goes back to Poland for help after 9/11. The CIA sets up this secret prison in Poland for waterboarding and other enhanced interrogation techniques of people they capture in Afghanistan. They later destroy video evidence of this. And here's how some of that tape was described by journalist Jane Mayer, talking to PBS Frontline.
I was told if those videotapes had ever been seen, the reaction around the world would not have been survivable. So the CIA is in a panic.
The president of Poland denied publicly that there ever was this black site, but then the news leaked out. You reported on this for the Washington Post in 1995. When the news got out, did the Poles feel betrayed by Washington?
Yeah, they really felt that, you know, they were an incredibly loyal ally, and they'd worked for us and risked their lives for us around the world. And so they agreed, the president of Poland agreed when George W. Bush made the request after 9/11. And they agreed with the sense that, okay, if we're going to break Polish law, America's going to have our back because America's going to keep this secret. And then America leaked on it. And so the Poles were left very much holding the bag, sort of responsible for this. And they were really in a tizzy about it because they didn't really quite know. Because, as you said, the president of Poland had for years denied that Poland was involved in anything like this. And he basically has to backtrack and say, okay, yeah, what happened? But we didn't know what was going on inside that house.
Well, and so for the Poles you spoke to for this book, what do they take away from these chapters and others you write about in your book? Is it that if you are very eager as a country to cooperate with the CIA and Washington, beware?
Yeah, that's part of the sort of the lesson, if you will. And many Polish politicians have said in the future they're going to be far more reluctant to agree to a request by the CIA or the United States government for any type of secret operation, especially something that is borderline legal. But at the same time, if you look at a country like Poland, it's hard for them as a small country to say no when America comes asking. Mm. And so subsequent to the black site, the Poles have continued to spy on behalf of the United States around the world. They've conducted operations in Iran, looking at Iran's nuclear capabilities, for example. They remain very much a loyal ally, but clearly the situation with the black sites was, put it mildly, a black mark on the name of the United States.
And finally, John, you dug up a lot of this story when you were based in Warsaw in the 90s for the Washington Post. So why write a book now on this U.S.-Polish spy alliance?
That's a great question. I think one of the things that really interested me was that there's been a lot of talk in the United States about why should we have alliances and why are alliances important and aren't alliances just a drag on us because we have to support all these countries around the world. And I think that this story shows very clearly that America is a superpower, not in spite of its alliances, but because of its friends. These nations around the world who are friendly to the United States do things for us that we can't do. I mean, in a period of time when we had no access to Pyongyang, no access to Cuba, no access to Iran, the Poles were in those countries looking out for our interests and doing things on our behalf. And that needs to be kind of noticed and credited, I think.
John Pomfret is a former foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, and his book is From Warsaw with Love: Polish Spies, the CIA, and the Forging of an Unlikely Alliance. And you can read an excerpt at our website, hereandnow.org. John, thanks very much.
Scott, thanks so much for having me.
We're going to investigate a musical instrument that's at the center of salsa music, the cowbell. Musicians play it with a percussive rhythm to keep time. But this instrument that is so important is really hard to find, and it turns out only a few people in the country can handcraft the cowbell. Mayan Silver of member station WUWM in Milwaukee introduces us to one of them.
So to refresh your ear, I go back to the high.
Ulysses Santiago is using a drumstick to play a few of the brightly colored cowbells in his music studio / showroom. It's inside his home in Caledonia, 20 minutes south of Milwaukee. About 30 bells line the shelves along one wall. They're different sizes and shapes to make different sounds. Santiago demonstrates some of the tones: high, mid-high, low. The bells are painted in bold reds, purples, and blues. Each resonates differently depending on how they're held or struck.
So if you want it open, like, you want it more muffled, this is the same exactly bell. You can hit it on the side, in the middle. So you got to know how to combine all that. And different musicians have their unique style. That's what the beautiful thing about this instrument.
Santiago sells his bells under the name Yuli Percussion. They've been picked up nationally and internationally by big names like Puerto Rico's El Gran Combo, percussionists from Mark Anthony. Here, the band Don Perignon y la Puerto Riqueña is using one of Santiago's creations.
It's so many artists that are accepting my instruments, and I've been very blessed with that.
Santiago says after a lull due to the COVID-19 pandemic, his cowbells are flying off the shelves.
It's like every other day I'm shipping bells out.
Santiago has spent years as a steel worker. His day job is assembling and maintaining railroad equipment. He's a percussionist in his spare time. But about 4 years ago, he felt called to action after Cali Rivera, master cowbell artisan of the Bronx, New York, passed away.
That's actually how this came, because I wanted his bell so bad, and I knew I couldn't get his bell, so I had that feeling as well. Hold on, I work with steel. I'm a musician, so let me attempt to try to make it, and it happened, you know.
Santiago set up shop in his garage, hung a large Puerto Rican flag on the wall, and built contraptions made out of wooden blocks, steel, and old railroad bumpers to help handcraft cowbells.
Yeah, so I had to come up with all these fixtures to make my life easier.
Santiago has mastered the rhythm of making a cowbell. He's self-taught, learning by trial and error. Here's his method. He cleans an hourglass-shaped piece of steel, bends it in half, pounds it multiple times until it forms the shape of a bell, welds the bent formation together, waits for it to cool down, grinds the metal so there's no sharp edges, cleans it again, powder coats it with a special gun, which creates a colorful, shiny finish. Then he bakes it in a big oven in his garage.
Put it like in 420 degrees or 400 degrees and there for 30 minutes. And then the powder melts to the steel.
Out comes a Yuli percussion cowbell.
This is the stamp for Yuli percussion.
On a recent afternoon, Santiago jammed with his two friends, Jose Santaia and Tony Ayala. They're using several different Yuli percussion bells, timbales, bongos, and congas, playing rhythms like the cha-cha and Mozambique. Playing the rhythms is an art and a science, much like creating the bells themselves. So, Santiago says he's still pushing himself to perfect his craft.
You know, we don't have no prints or nothing. It's all by head, you know, until we get the right bent, the right shape, and for the right sound.
Meanwhile, Yuli percussion cowbells are signposts for staying on beat. Handcrafted for salsa bands far and wide. For Here and Now, I'm Mayan Silver.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.